Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Lucky Land Casino asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Well, hello, everyone, and welcome to Talk Nerdy. Today is Monday, April 30th, and I'm your host, Kara Santa Maria. And this week, we have a fascinating conversation for you. But before we dive into it, I want to thank those of you who made Talk Nerdy possible. Remember, Talk Nerdy is and will always be 100% free to download. This is my commitment to you. And the way that I am able to support the show, because it does take quite a bit of time. And at this point now, I have extra help in the form of editing and some administrative support. So the way that I can afford to do that and focus on my schoolwork and, you know, all my other jobs that I do is mostly from listener support from people like you. Those of you who can afford to support the show make it so that those who can't don't have to, and that they're able to listen to it week after week for free. So if you do want to support the show, there's a few ways to do it. You can go to patreon.com/talknerdy. That's kind of the number one choice. It's a centralized hub. Everything is in one place, and you'll see all of the options right there where you can pledge your support. You can also visit my website. It's carasantamaria.com, where you can see other options like shopping in the Talk Nerdy store. Now, I know it's limited. I do have some last minute stock of a handful of things. I'm trying to sell those out because I will soon be opening a new Talk Nerdy store. If you guys have any insights, if you have anything you've been wanting to see offered, this new store is going to have a lot more product offerings because it's going to be a print on demand model. And I'm busy designing and getting everything ready for you. It's very exciting. But yeah, if you've got ideas, shoot me a tweet at Kara Santa Maria or hit me up on Facebook, or you can even send an email to shoptalknerdy@gmail.com. Okay. So those are all the ways that you can support the show. I thank you so, so much. Those of you who did so this week, you have earned a shout out at the top of the show. And that includes Jeffrey Sewell, who I think is our top supporter of all time. Thank you so, so much, Jeffrey. Also, Brian Holden, another very high level supporter, along with Gabriel Felipe Jaramillo Gonzalez, Jafe, the Honorable Husband, Jonathan Wright, Charles Payett, Jeffrey Perez, Pedro M. Rosario Barbosa, David J. E. Smith, the Zombie Drummer, and of course, Phil T-Bear. Thank you all so, so very much. So without any further ado, let's dive into this episode. It's a really, really good one, you guys. So this week, I have a chat with journalist and author Sharon Weinberger. She's actually the executive editor for news at Foreign Policy. She's a global fellow at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. She used to be the national security editor at The Intercept. And we talk about her brand new book. It's called The Imagineers of War, The Untold Story of DARPA, the Pentagon Agency that Changed the World. It's now actually available in paperback form, and you can grab it wherever books are sold. There is a link in the show notes. So guys, without any further ado, here she is, Sharon Weinberger. Well, Sharon, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thanks for having me on.
So I'm really excited to talk about your new book, The Imagineers of War, The Untold Story of DARPA, the Pentagon Agency that Changed the World. And of course, reading all about the work that you do, you have spent a lot of time writing about national security, writing about intelligence. And so some people listening to the show might wonder, what does this have to do with science? But DARPA is all about science, isn't it?
Yes, it is. I mean, my career over the past almost two decades has really been about the intersection of science and technology with national security, meaning looking at how is science conducted in what I call the national security state, you know, different than science that may be conducted in industry, whether Google or Facebook or academia or funded by the National Science Foundation or National Institutes for Health. So DARPA, the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, is the research and development arm of the Pentagon and a major funder of different science and technology projects around the United States.
Yeah, so I have to admit that when I was in graduate school working on my master's, we were doing research using what they call primary neuronal cell cultures, these little cultures of neurons from mice that grew independently outside of the body in vitro that we would do experiments on. And we were fully funded by a DARPA grant.
Yeah, that doesn't surprise me. I mean, it may not have surprised you at the time, or it may have, but I think a lot of people who are not involved in those sorts of projects don't realize that DARPA, though it's a Pentagon agency, does fund quite a bit of research and academia at universities. There's a generation of computer scientists that are developing artificial intelligence whose graduate school careers were made possible by DARPA funding in the 1980s.
Yeah, it is really fascinating. And of course, when we think about kind of military technology, or we think about what the Pentagon does, we think about war machines, but that's not the only thing. It's actually probably not even the largest thing that the Pentagon funds, is it?
No, well, actually, in terms of money, so building weapons is a really, really expensive business. And that's sort of the disparity that exists. So the Pentagon has long been involved in funding what's called basic research or basic science. This is areas of science where there's not maybe an immediate application to weapons. And that's actually fairly cheap to fund compared to building, let's say, an F-35 fighter. But the Pentagon has long been involved in funding science. You know, one of the things that I look at with DARPA is that there's been a tension that exists in the agency going back to its origins to 1958, which is this a science agency that pursues national security, or is it a national security agency that pursues science? Meaning, what is its primary goal, good science or sort of good, better national security?
And what did you discover?
What I discovered is it depends on the time period of the agency. So literally in its first days in 1958, there was a fundamental tension there because the first director was a businessman. He was a former vice president at General Electric, and he really saw it as a national security agency. Whereas the first science director at DARPA was a nuclear physicist who really saw it as a science agency. And so it's gone back and forth over the years. There have been directors that really just wanted it to do first-class science. That hopefully benefits national security. And then there have been directors in who said, no, our goal, you know, we build weapons. We help the Pentagon wage war. And, you know, I start the book with a quote from a guy named William Godel, who was one of the first sort of senior officials in DARPA at its founding. And he had this statement back in the early days of DARPA saying that, you know, the launch of Sputnik, this is the first artificial satellite launched by the Soviet Union, which sparked the creation of DARPA. He said, we've entered a new era and we should no longer serve scientists. Rather, scientists ought to be made to serve, meaning we don't fund science for science's sake, but so that they help national security.
So DARPA was really formed in response to Sputnik.
Yeah. So in October of 1957, the Soviet Union launched Sputnik, the world's first artificial satellite, which, you know, signaled to the world, or at least to the United States, that they were ahead in the space race. And there's sort of a mythology that's grown up around Sputnik that, you know, the nation instantly fell into a panic. And in reality, it was really much more of a politically engineered panic that critics of President Eisenhower seized upon it as evidence that the United States had fallen behind, that he hadn't taken the threat seriously. Of course, President Eisenhower knew that the United States was also conducting classified projects. We were developing the world's first spy satellites. We had the U2 spy plane. But nonetheless, he really had to face, this criticism that was coming in. So he authorized the creation of what was then known as ARPA, the Advanced Research Projects Agency. And that was the nation's first space agency. It consolidated all of the rocket, space, and missile defense programs that were spread out around the Army, the Air Force, and Navy, and included Wernher von Braun, the German rocket scientist, and his colleagues who were down in Alabama. And it put them all under this first space agency. This predates the creation of NASA. And the goal of this new agency was to get the United States into space as quickly as possible.
Oh, wow. Okay. So this was even before NASA was NACA?
Even before, well, no. So NACA existed, but NASA did not.
Okay.
And so there was no agency, no single agency trying to get the United States into space. Now, when Eisenhower authorized the creation of ARPA, what later became DARPA, what he did say was that he always planned to have a civilian space agency. He was being lobbied very hard by his scientific advisors who didn't want the Pentagon. They didn't want the military to control all of space. And so even when he authorized the creation of ARPA, he said that, eventually there would be a civilian agency and then the civilian rocket and satellite programs would go over to this new agency, which ended up being NASA.
Oh, interesting. Okay. So it's funny that all of this predates, I think, some of the military history that we often think of when we think of science, like the Manhattan Project, like Operation Paperclip, like some of the kind of shadier military, plans that involved some very famous scientists. And of course, the sort of moral fallout that happened after that, because all of that was occurring right around and immediately after World War II.
Yeah, so it's all sort of intertwined history in a way. So, of course, Wernher von Braun, the rocket scientists who were brought over in the United States as part of the larger Operation Paperclip that you alluded to, this was the operation the United States used to sort of scoop up as many German scientists as they could, in part so the United States could benefit from their, their science and their engineering knowledge, but also to make sure they didn't fall into the hands of the Soviet Union. So the connection to that, to DARPA, is sort of twofold. One, Wernher von Braun was lobbying very hard. I mean, he wanted to get rockets into space, and instead he was sort of stuck in Alabama working on, sort of successors to the V-2 rocket. He was really thinking about space travel and getting the United States into space. Of course, didn't really care if it was for, Nazi Germany, the U.S. military, or NASA, just didn't care. So when, as I said, when DARPA was created in 1958, initially all of his work and the rocket scientist's work was brought under the umbrella of ARPA. And in fact, the Saturn rocket that was eventually used to take the Apollo mission to the moon, the first manned mission to the moon, was based on the work funded by DARPA in those early days, who decided to fund Wernher von Braun and the rocket scientists to work on Saturn. So that's the connection there. There's a second connection between that sort of post-World War II era and DARPA, which is a little bit that I went into in my book, which was this guy, William Godel, who rose to be the deputy director of DARPA. He had been involved. He had been an intelligence operative in World War II, and he had been involved in getting some German as well as Russian scientists over to the United States. And he was sort of this spooky intelligence character. And when DARPA was created in 1958, he was basically sort of secretly installed at DARPA to represent the interests of the intelligence community and had sort of a lasting impact on the direction of DARPA over the years.
Oh, gosh, it's so fascinating thinking about the fact that so many basically Nazi scientists, like scientists who actually did work that can be considered now, pre-Nuremberg, incredibly unethical, were actually chosen to come to these kind of United States operations for the reasons that you mentioned. But it must have caused, an air of disquiet, especially amongst intelligence officials, worried about, are these people, where are their allegiances lying?
I think the disquiet was more that they were trying to keep it very, very quiet so the public can find out. I mean, there's sort of it's an interesting history in its own right, because for so long, a lot of that was whitewashed by the national security institutions in the United States because they didn't want those questions asked. I mean, the military and the Pentagon tends to be very practical because they're tasked to do something. They're tasked to keep ahead of national security. You know, they really thought we were facing, you know, nuclear apocalypse to the Soviet Union, and you do whatever you can. You take whatever technology and science. So it's not that they weren't aware of those issues or even that they didn't care. They just saw their mission as singular to get the best scientists and engineers. And, you know, that meant sort of sweeping a lot of unpleasant truths under the rug. But that's a lot of the history of the Pentagon.
Absolutely. I mean, that's a lot of the history of what happens, I think, when science and the military meet. And of course, that's such an interesting theme in your book, because yes, depending on the leadership, the goal might shift from funding basic science that might have military applications to funding military science that might have civilian applications. But ultimately, you know, this research that's been funded over the years by DARPA has led to death and destruction, but it has also led to incredible life-changing technologies that I don't think we would know how to live without.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think the best example of that, and the one that really has cemented DARPA's reputation over the years, is the internet, which was the creation of DARPA's ARPANET project. That was the first project to network computers across the United States, and is the direct precursor, predecessor to the modern internet. You know, and so this, you know, people, to include DARPA, people who are familiar with DARPA always say, well, look at this wonderful thing that DARPA did. It created the internet. And what I always tell people is that that's phenomenal. And of course, that should be counted as a great success. DARPA is a very successful agency, but the failures matter as well. DARPA directors have this ongoing joke, you know, not even a joke, but they'll often say, you know, maybe 90%, maybe 85% of our projects fail. But if we have one internet, if we have one, you know, stealth aircraft, that our successes make it all worthwhile. And I guess my approach in doing the book is saying that even if we take that at face value, you have to look at the failures, because the failures aren't just something that didn't work out. They're often failures that had really devastating consequences. So, for instance, a lot of the book, I look at what a lot of material that has now been declassified about DARPA's involvement in the Vietnam War. One of the things that DARPA has gladly sort of swept under the rug or not taken credit for is they were the agency that introduced chemical defoliation to Vietnam. Most people today associate that correctly with Agent Orange. DARPA introduced what were called the rainbow agents because there was Agent Orange, Agent Pink, Agent Purple. We now refer to most of them just as Agent Orange because it was the most widely used chemical defoliant. That was a DARPA project. That was a failure that has a lasting health consequence for Vietnamese, for people in Southeast Asia, and American servicemen and women.
It's interesting because we often associate Agent Orange with the corporations that were involved, like DuPont or like Monsanto. We don't often think about the fact that it was a government-funded initiative, but of course it was a military initiative.
Yeah, I don't think Monsanto's woke up one day. I mean, not to absolve them of responsibility, but I don't think it was Monsanto's. In fact, I can tell you it was not Monsanto's that said, let's go use it for defoliation in Vietnam. That was the idea of military planners, and particularly DARPA.
Yeah. And it kind of goes to show what happens, I think, when the interests, the military interests, sort of maybe outweigh some of the concerns about lasting effects. And I think that as a nation, we don't have the best track record in many aspects, whether we're talking about environmental aspects, whether we're talking about putting junk into space. We're not the best at thinking through the consequences of our actions.
Well, that's exactly it. And this is not to demonize anyone. You know, ironically, the person who was most responsible for DARPA's chemical defoliation project was, again, this gentleman I referred to, William Goeddel. And, you know, he wasn't some, you know, demon who just didn't care about health effects, but he thought he had found a way. He was trying to help the South Vietnamese military fight the Viet Cong, the communist insurgency. And so he was looking for tactics and techniques to help them in jungle warfare, precisely because he knew that if the U.S. introduced its own conventional troops, it would be a disaster. I mean, he really foresaw what the Vietnam War became, and was trying to find out, like, how do you help the militaries work, you know, fight themselves? And one idea he had seen used by the British before was chemical defoliation, because the Viet Cong were using jungle cover to attack South Vietnamese troops. And, you know, in his mind, you know, he just didn't think like, okay, well, maybe we should look at the health effects. Maybe there's testing. He was trying to think, how do you win a war quickly? So it wasn't done out of sort of, you know, bad intentions, mm-hmm. but it certainly was done without thinking about the long-term consequences.
Yeah. And I mean, you see that even historically pre-DARPA. And like you said, all of these things do start to blur a little bit. Like when we look into the Manhattan Project and we look at like what needed to be done at the time, or at least what felt like needed to be done. And then a lot of the statements that were made and the regret that was shown by the different scientists that were involved.
Yeah, I mean, the Manhattan Project is a little bit of a related issue. I mean, I think everyone who worked on it, I mean, there were very few people who left. I mean, I think there was maybe only one or two cases of people who actually left during the project for moral mm-hmm. reasons. You know, people knew they were trying to fight Nazi Germany. People knew they were trying to fight Germany. They felt that this was an important project for the good of national security. And it wasn't that they were unaware of what the long-term consequences could be, but the short-term needs of a real national security threat is what motivated them.
Yeah. And of course, it's always easy to think about, you know, what could happen. It's another thing when you finally see what does happen and that, you know, those regrets may start to set in that way. And that's the thing. A lot of times when we're talking about war machines or we're talking about strategic technology, we're talking about two different buckets, right? We're talking about one bucket of playing chess and hoping that we never have to use them. And then we're talking about the bucket of what happens when we do have to use them.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's really, I think, one of the important, I don't know, consequences, the important conversations to be had about deproliferation of nuclear weapons. And so how much control or impact does DARPA have on our current nuclear arsenal?
So DARPA is actually pretty separate from the nuclear weapons complex, and that's by design. You know, the Department of Defense does not develop nuclear weapons. It's done under the Department of Energy and the nuclear weapons laboratories. The military is responsible for coming up with the requirements and for the missiles and for everything around it and for operating them. And so DARPA pretty much, it's actually been somewhat controversial over the years because DARPA has been had some projects in nuclear-related research, sometimes for nuclear energy. My first book was actually about a small DARPA project called an isomer bomb, which developed sort of a fourth-generation weapon. And it was quite controversial for a number of reasons. A, because it was a, you know, it was the idea of building a nuclear hand grenade, which was ridiculous. Secondly, it just wasn't going to work. It was based on bad science. And then sort of another reason was this really, it's very touchy for the Pentagon to get involved. It's not supposed to be involved in nuclear weapons research, meaning in design. The way DARPA kind of got around it in that case is they said it's not, it wasn't nuclear fission or fusion. It was sort of a different nuclear reaction. But that project was ended by Congress.
It's such a weird like distinction to make, like exactly what is the science behind the explosion that we're producing versus like what is the use of this weapon? That's random to me. I mean, maybe it goes deeper than that, but it seems weird to be like, oh, we found a nuke loophole.
Well, it, you know, a lot of government and a lot of government research is about turf battles. So it's not, on one hand, it's not totally surprising that DARPA would want to get involved in an area that, you know, sort of belongs to another part of government. But anything in the nuclear world does tend to be quite controversial because, A, there are actually, you know, there's congressional legislation that limits the design and development of new nuclear warheads. And then, of course, you have this traditional division within government. For the most part, I think it's safe to say that DARPA does not get involved in sort of the nuclear weapons business. What it has done over the years and what has always been a fundamental part of its mission going back to its creation was it was tasked when it was created in 1958 with working on missile defenses. So, you know, projects to defend against nuclear attack. One of DARPA's first projects in its early days of 1958 was this concept of developing, it's one of my favorite DARPA projects, how crazy it was. It was going to develop a planetary force field that was going to stop, you know, nuclear warheads from, you know, re-entering the atmosphere. And the way it was going to do this was based on this theory that if you launch nuclear weapons in the upper atmosphere, they basically create these killer electrons that could basically could fry nuclear weapons. And so DARPA, along with the Air Force in 1958, they went out into the ocean and they launched and set off nuclear weapons in the upper atmosphere to see if it was possible to create this killer electron belt. It didn't work. It was leaked to the New York Times and called the greatest experiment ever. I mean, because, you know, if you think that's crazy, like, we did an experiment to create a planetary force field. And I remember that in the memoirs of DARPA's chief scientist, he sort of wrote tongue in cheek, like, yes, it didn't work, because it turned out that, you know, so what happens is these electrons get caught in what we now know as the Van Allen belt, which wasn't named at the time. Mm-hmm. But it turned out that the killer electrons decay too quickly to really make a force field. And so this chief scientist wrote tongue in cheek, you know, maybe there's another planet out there where this would work.
Yeah. But it again goes to show how interesting it is that these turf wars, they matter and they have a real impact, but that still doesn't prevent DARPA from exploding nuclear weapons to then try to prevent weapons. So even though they are not making them, they're still using them and potentially putting a lot of people at risk.
Right. One of my other favorite DARPA projects, again, from those very early years, was this thing called Project Orion. And it was going to be a spaceship that was powered by exploding thermonuclear weapons that would basically, you know, enable the thrust of this spaceship. And the scientists working on it, so DARPA funded, you know, the initial sort of design work on this thermonuclear weapon powered spaceship. And one of the scientists who worked on it, Freeman Dyson, he said he estimated that the fallout from launching the spaceship would kill on average from the radiation from you know, basically cancers that result from it, 10 people per year. So every launch of the spaceship, you basically doomed on average 10 people to death.
Ugh.
You know, there's a story that they showed a mock-up of the spaceship with its like 500 thermonuclear weapons to President Kennedy, who was just appalled.
Yeah.
And it was eventually canceled.
Well, good. I'm glad that there was at least some foresight there.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that was not a winner.
No, but that doesn't mean that there haven't been, you know, grave mistakes and big errors. And I think it's interesting that you mentioned that it was important for you in this book to really dig into the failures, because of course, we all appreciate kind of Elon Musk's candor when he talks about how you really can't make progress without actively failing, and failure is how we learn from our mistakes and how we lead to success. But it's one thing if you're, you know, failing financially, or you're failing in terms of, you know, the human spirit. It's another thing if your failures involve death and destruction.
Well, exactly. And, you know, it's not enough to say, you know, another thing that one of the DARPA directors like to say is we never remember the failures. We try things over and over again, you know, meaning we don't get discouraged by the failures. And I think there's some truth to that. But the thing is, you better have learned from your failures. I mean, I think when Elon Musk talks about failures, you know, it means that we learn from them. The danger that DARPA projects have at times is that they don't have much of an institutional memory as an organization, because the way it works is that all of the employees are there temporarily. Program managers, meaning the people who manage these projects, come in for terms of about 2 to 5 years. There's exceptions. There's people there shorter, people there a little bit longer, but there are no permanent employees. So you'll oftentimes have program managers who start projects who didn't know that pretty much that same project was done, you know, 20 years ago. And so I guess, you know, part of that is that could be good because they don't get discouraged, but, you know, hopefully you learn from the failures of the other projects. And where I've seen DARPA projects go really off the rails or really wrong is precisely when you get someone who doesn't understand and didn't know what were the failures before.
Ugh, I mean, it's just so, I don't know, symbolic of what we often see in our leadership, both in the executive and in our legislative branches, just this inability in American culture to say, oh, we tried that once. It didn't go over well. Maybe we shouldn't do it again.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woohooer, a hand clapper, a high fiver? I kind of like the high five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Again, I mean, it is a real, I think, classically American problem, and I'm kind of not surprised to hear that it's recapitulated at DARPA. In a way, I think NASA is maybe a counterpoint to that, because I do think that, you know, although NASA has plenty of failures, I think NASA has at least historically attempted to learn from its failure the way that Elon Musk is sort of speaking about now.
Yeah, well, NASA has its own.
You're like, well.
Yeah, I don't. yeah, I don't know that I totally agree with that statement. I mean, when you
please enlighten me.
Well, I am not a NASA expert by any means, but I think when you've looked at the major mission failures of NASA, meaning those that have actually resulted in the loss of life, it was actually precisely from things where they didn't learn the lessons. Mm. NASA is in a very different, I mean, it's actually interesting to look at the differences between NASA and DARPA. NASA is really in a rut now. If you look at where they've gone the past 10 years, like, which is not their fault, it's because, you know, NASA, like any agency, has to be tasked by the president, by the executive branch. So it's like, we're going to Mars. We're going to go moon to Mars. No, we're going to go to Mars. Maybe we're not going to go to Mars. You know, I mean, NASA has really not been in the innovation game for a while now. I mean, you look at what their mission is and what they're trying to do. NASA has, I think, over 10 times the budget of DARPA and doesn't produce nearly as much. Now, again, that's not NASA's fault per se. NASA has pre-baked in programs, the International Space Station. It has things that it has to support.
Yeah, and it's become really bureaucratic, hasn't it?
Extremely bureaucratic, which is good for, I mean, sometimes you want bureaucracy, but not for, bureaucracy can be good for making sure people don't get killed when bureaucracy works right. What bureaucracy yes. is not good for is innovation. You know, the advantage of DARPA is that it can very quickly, if something's a failure, it can very quickly move money around. You can start new projects. It can kill projects because the employees go in and out. You know, you don't have these lifelong bureaucrats that have staked their entire career to one particular program. It's the great advantage of DARPA.
True. And I think that that's why we see kind of more innovation in the public-private partnerships like JPL or even like SpaceX, which, let's be honest, like their biggest contract comes from NASA. So, of course, in a way, they really are a NASA project. And I mean, one last thing about NASA, because that is not what this interview is about. With the new leader of NASA, with the new commissioner, I am definitely nervous to see what the future looks like. I'll leave that there. no comment
required.
Let me actually
provide a counterpoint to that without having any opinions. You know, historically, when I've looked, whether it's the heads of NASA or the heads of DARPA, it actually doesn't, you know, I think the presumption is that, like, you must have scientists as the head of scientific agencies. Mm-hmm. And there are a lot of advantages to having that. I will give you that. But actually, historically, what actually matters more at the very top is competence and vision. So not arguing that the current NASA incoming director has any of that. It's not saying that, but saying, you know, the first director of DARPA was mocked mercilessly by the chief scientist because he didn't have, he was a vice president of General Electric. You know, he was a smart guy, but he didn't have technical knowledge, didn't have scientific knowledge, but he had real vision. He had real leadership and he knew how to manage scientists and he wasn't stupid. So he wasn't supporting dumb projects, but he really made DARPA what it is today. Everything that we associate that's good about DARPA, a lack of bureaucracy, of moving quickly, of being extremely ambitious, was a product of that first director. And if you'd had a sign, to be fair, that the wackiest projects from DARPA's early days, like Project Orion, and which was the nuclear spaceship, the wacky planetary force field, those were not projects supported by the first director. He supported the Saturn rocket that actually took, you know, eventually took astronauts to moon. It was the scientist, the nuclear physicist who wanted those projects. So not, you know, it is really useful to have smart people at the heads of these agencies. There's a strong argument to have scientists as the head of them. But I'm just saying that, you know, you can have a non-scientist who can be the good head of a science and technology agency. It is possible. It's harder.
I think it's an important point to make, though, because it's true. Like, people who have dedicated their lives to a single focus, which oftentimes is the case with a PhD level scientist, that doesn't necessarily mean that they have any leadership capability, that they know how to manage, which is very important. or that they are going to be able to kind of kill their darlings in a way to see the bigger picture. I mean, some of them might have those skills, of course, but that it really takes a special person to be able to be, you know, incredibly competent in one area and incredibly competent in a completely different area. My biggest concern is that our new NASA administrator does not believe in climate change, which is a totally different issue, which I do think might should be a prerequisite for the job.
Yeah, it's actually interesting. So just today, I was asked by UnDark, which is a publication out of MIT, to write about something that I left out of the book. Mm-hmm. And you know, because DARPA has been involved in so many things over the years, I didn't write about every project. Instead of the one project that I wish I had done some interviews on it, but then just never thought to develop it into a chapter, was about how DARPA was the origins of our modern climate science program. I mean, you know, the climate science programs that contribute what we know today about global warming and about climate change all date back to the early 1970s at DARPA, when the Pentagon was worried about, the Soviet Union was doing geoengineering. They were trying to use nuclear weapons to redirect rivers for agriculture.
Of course, like you do.
As you do when you have, yeah. I mean, we did our own geoengineering, but not quite that ambitiously. And there were a lot of concerns about how changing the flows into the Arctic would affect the climate. What would it do? And so DARPA was tasked with the first climate modeling program. I mean, the idea of climate modeling didn't exist at the time. You know, you had weather forecasting and you had people looking at the atmosphere, but you didn't really combine the different disciplines. You had people looking at paleoclimates, but not combined. So DARPA created the first sort of interdisciplinary program. They brought all these scientists together to do the first climate modeling, to speak with paleoclimate researchers, to speak with the meteorologists. And that eventually led to the creation of a national climate program, all out of concerns about the Soviet Union and geoengineering. So you do have these strange cross sections between the Pentagon and science.
Oh, that's really interesting too, that, you know, it's become such a politicized issue, climate science, that, you know, it's almost hard to believe somebody when they just blanket say that it's a hoax or that they don't believe in it. It really does show how limited their scientific understanding is, because even these large institutions, large corporations like oil companies, have very good climate scientists on staff, because of course it affects their bottom line, global warming. And it's something that you think of as almost these groups that are sort of the enemy when it comes to climate science. In essence, they are equally, if not more competent than sort of what we think of as the allied, quote unquote, I'm doing massive air quotes right now, groups. And so I'm kind of not surprised that even, you know, DARPA would have had, because I don't know why. I think that people make the distinction that defense is a right wing issue, and that defense by definition kind of falls on the same ideological spectrum as climate denialism. But there's no reason that those two things should have any relation to one another.
Yeah, I mean, I have my own views on that, looking at DARPA's history with it. But I think, you know, the biggest mistake for climate research was, that it got, which is no particular person's fault, but it has become so politicized. It became sort of part of a political movement, which then created sort of a push against it. It's just unfortunate.
Absolutely. So, you know, I really want to take some time to dive into some of these kinds of these failures, or really just these interesting projects that maybe most people didn't know came out of DARPA. You mentioned the internet, and I think that's, you know, obviously probably the flag that they like to fly. And it is a really important, I mean, gosh, I cannot imagine life without the internet. It is massively important. And you mentioned Agent Orange, which obviously had a massive historical ramifications. But when I think about modern defense and modern intelligence, I think the thing that really strikes me first and foremost is surveillance and drones. Those are the two big things that, like, my mind first goes to. And those are very, very fundamentally DARPA initiatives, aren't they?
Yeah. So drones, you know, DARPA's history with drones goes back to the Vietnam War, when they tried out some smaller drones for surveillance. And then actually later in the Vietnam War in the 1970s, they developed the first armed drone, which was used along the demilitarized zone between North and South Vietnam. And then later, but those projects, that didn't work. The drones kept failing, kept falling out of the sky, essentially. In the 1980s, DARPA again turned back to unmanned aircraft drones. And they most famously funded an Israeli-born aeronautical engineer working in the United States to build what later became the Predator aircraft. It was called Amber at the time, and it was basically to develop a long-lasting surveillance aircraft. And so the successor to that, bought by the CIA and by the Air Force, was the Predator drone and the armed Predator drone that we've all seen footage of from different countries around the world. So very much a DARPA project.
Interesting. And so I had no idea that there were armed drones that early. I thought of them as like a very classical kind of Afghanistan, Iraq, like Middle East initiative. But obviously the technology must have existed prior to their use.
You're right. Meaning they tried them out in the Vietnam War, but there were problems with the drone itself, meaning, you know, building a drone that could stay up in the air, be controlled and not crash, and then actually arming it. So they had, it was actually, I think the drone was called the Snoopy drone. It was the nickname of it.
Of course, it would be called that. Come on. Yeah.
And they did try arming it, but it never actually shot. So far as I know, but a lot of the people who worked on it died, but from all of the evidence and report and the interviews I did, it was never used successfully in Vietnam. And then sort of after Vietnam, there wasn't really a need for it for a number of years. So nobody developed it again until, you know, working your way into the late 1990s, going up to 2001.
And then, of course, there were, you know, all sorts of kind of ethical issues around its use, which, you know, it's important to separate the ethics from the development and technology, but it's also important to fully integrate the ethics with the development and technology. That doesn't mean that the same people who are building these things or designing these things need to be the people who are making decisions about their use, but there does need to be massive oversight.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's not just oversight. You know, what is so interesting about DARPA's contributions to drone warfare, and whether that's a success or a failure, is you have to sort of ask yourself, you know, what makes for a success? So the Predator drone, you know, DARPA often says this is one of our successful projects. But what I guess what I ask is, if the end goal of technology is to solve warfare, to end wars, I think you can look at the history of the past 16 years of drone warfare and say it has not been terribly successful. It's very good at killing people, but has it actually brought, whether it's insurgencies or terror, you know, whether it's actually achieved our goals of national security? I think it has a much more checkered record.
Yeah, yeah. Is it actually preventing further dispute or helping with recruitment? That's, you know, a whole other conversation. But it's not just the drone warfare that sticks out in my head, but of course, the big data mining, the intelligence kind of, I don't know if you want to call them failures or successes. I guess it depends on who you ask. But coming out of the kind of Afghanistan war, basically this, I don't know what you want to call it, this sort of 1984, you know, people, millennials now, people who aren't too much younger than me, don't know life without being in wartime. And this kind of modern war has brought on a real change in how we view privacy. And DARPA's had a lot to do with that, haven't they?
Yeah, I think the most famous project that DARPA was known for in the post 9/11 years relating to privacy and data was a program called Total Information Awareness. So DARPA actually, even before 9/11, had been involved in what, you know, might be called data mining. Some people call it pattern analysis. Whatever it was looking at, can you use data to predict major terrorist attacks? So lo and behold, 9/11 comes around, and this was just sort of an initial research project. And the people behind this project said, look, we could do something much, much bigger. You know, it seemed very attractive at the time. Like, yeah, oh my God, if we could have stopped 9/11, what a wonderful use of science and technology. So there were a couple problems with this. One was what they were proposing to do, which was to combine basically open data. I mean, not even open data, but, you know, records, medical records, car rental records, credit card records, and to combine it with classified data. So this is basically trawling through the data of U.S. citizens, U.S. residents, people in the United States. That was one problem. The second problem was perceptual, that the head of this program was a gentleman named retired Admiral John Poindexter, who had been a national security advisor to Ronald Reagan, and more importantly, had been a major figure in the Iran-Contra scandal. And actually had been convicted of lying to Congress, had the conviction overturned. So putting this, you know, someone who was quite controversial as the head of a program that had potential privacy implications was a disaster waiting to happen. And the New York Times wrote about the program not long after it started. it indeed became this public relations disaster for DARPA.
I was just thinking about this. Can you imagine if Facebook had been around in 2001? Like, Facebook was founded in 04. Like, think about how much more data they might have had access to.
It's not just the data. It's our relationship to the data. I mean, in some ways, when I look back at the history of total information awareness and the brouhaha over it, it actually seems almost innocent. You know, people are worried, oh my God, they'll get my credit card records. Well, what about all of your personal photos? What about all of your family connections? What about all of your friends? What about your everything that you put online? The scope of the data that it's available is so much more. And it's almost as if our notions of privacy and how to protect privacy have no way of keeping up with it.
Yeah, I don't really want to know what DARPA might be working on with regards to our Facebook data right now. I wouldn't be surprised if something is happening there. But that's really the tough thing about writing a book like this and really doing the work that you do, because you didn't just write this book. You've written for, you know, so many different outlets. You were the national security editor at The Intercept. You are the executive editor at Foreign Policy, and you've obviously written for a ton of different outlets, both academic and kind of more, I don't know what you would call it, sort of public facing. And that must be a tough part of your job, is that you have to comb through records that people don't want you to be reading. You have to look at FOIA requests, you have to wait until things are declassified, and you have to piece together information that's not always complete, right? You're dealing with reading pages where most of the text is redacted.
Well, not in all cases. I mean, so, you know, you never have everything you want. I would say this book relied on different sets of records. So one was declassification and records that go into the National Archives and Record Administration. So there's a lot of different laws that govern this. But after about 30 years, many records go called automatic declassification. It's much harder than that, much more complex, and takes actually a lot more time, but that's sort of the law, more or less. And so you can go to the National Archives and Record Administration and you can trawl through, you know, DARPA's records from 1958, 1959, basically up till about 73 or 74. And that's about when things cut off. And there you have people's original notes from, you know, you can look at, you know, meeting minutes from 1962. There are still records that are still classified that were of a higher classification. So that's one set of records. And those are not, I mean, it's a gold mine because it's not redacted. There were also archives around the country I was able to rely on, which were different scientists' personal records, their professional records of associating with DARPA. A third set of records were I filed actually a lawsuit under the Freedom of Information Act to obtain a lot of information, namely historical interviews that DARPA had commissioned with directors. And I won that lawsuit. And so actually I got all of those records and they were not redacted. Then there are sort of another set, which you refer to, things that are heavily redacted. And those are things that there are still things that are still classified. You know, I often wondered, you know, what would happen if I had access to everything I ever needed? I think it would provide additional details. I don't think it would fundamentally change my perception or the history I wrote of DARPA. I think we have a complete enough of a record about what they've done, what's important, what worked, what went wrong, to have a good historical record.
I love how modest you are, especially in this description, because yes, it's your job. And I think it's something that you've been doing for a long time and you're used to doing it. But most journalists don't have to file FOIA lawsuits to cover what they want to write about. Some
do. National security journalists do.
There you go. Exactly. And so, and obviously it's tough, right? You're up against a lot more barricades, but at the same time, you must get such a sense of accomplishment from the work when you actually do make breakthroughs and when you actually kind of uncover something or discover something that you get to share with people that maybe they weren't aware of before.
Well, of course. I mean, you know, I know I have friends who are journalists in many other areas and who do great work, that they don't have to file FOIAs makes their work no less rewarding or challenging. But I think what does attract people to national security journalism in part is the secrecy, the idea when you find something out, it's this tremendous find. I think what I also have is a tremendous sense of self-righteousness that I, this is my taxpayer dollars. It is your taxpayer dollars. And we absolutely have, the government has classification. There are things that are legitimately kept secret for national security, but there are way too many things that are kept secret because it's embarrassing or because it was a failure. And then this real element of self-righteousness for me kicks in, that that's my government. It's my money. It's your money. It's everyone's money. We have a right to know. And luckily, there are laws that enable us to know, and we should take advantage of them. And that's what I try to do.
And of course, there's always that line that you have the potential to come up against, which is sort of the working with whistleblowers line, where it's up to you as a journalist to figure out, once you have access to something, whether or not it is right or it is your duty to report, because maybe it does reveal something that's classified. Maybe the reason it's classified is for actual national security purposes and not for these reasons of just government embarrassment. And it must be kind of a lot of responsibility in the few, or maybe you've experienced this many times. I would assume it's probably not happened that many times throughout your career, but I have no idea. It seems like a lot of responsibility to have to make that call.
Yeah, I mean, luckily with the DARPA book, because it was primarily historical, I don't recall that I ever held anything back. I mean, there were actually times that people perhaps even unknowingly gave me information that may have been still classified. I don't think anybody did so knowingly, but there was nothing that I felt needed to be held back because it would endanger national security. There certainly are other parts of my job where I get those requests. And I guess my standard is always, you know, you weigh the public's right to know versus what damage it could do. I mean, I don't think there's any journalist out there who wants to purposely endanger national security. But in a sense, you are sort of being put up in a form of judgment. You know, if the government argues that something could actually endanger sources, methods, people, you know, you have to decide.
Yeah, and unfortunately, they're probably going to argue that when there is something embarrassing that they're trying to ensure the public doesn't hear about. And that's really where you have to make that distinction. And it's important that there are people like you kind of putting your necks on the line doing that, so that we as a public can be more informed. And so, A, I have to thank you for that. But B, I have to thank you for writing such a fascinating book. I love that the work that you've done over the years has been featured in everything from Foreign Policy and WAPO to, you know, Nature and Discover, because that intersection between defense and national security and science is a real one. And it's great to see that there are specialists who really focus on it. So Sharon, before I let you go, I have to request from you, I close every episode by asking my guests the same two questions. And I was hoping that I could do the same with you.
Sure.
Awesome. Okay. So these are super big picture questions, just to warn you. So in whatever context is relevant to you today, you know, it could be personal, professional, it could be a global context. The first question is, what is the thing that really does keep you up the most at night? What are you really focused on and maybe obsessing about that you know, you're kind of discouraged when you look to the future? And on the flip side of that, so we don't end on like literally the most depressing note ever, what are you genuinely hopeful and optimistic about when you look to the future?
Those are two great questions.
And I'm so interested in your perspective too, because you're my first guest who's really had a focus in this area.
So I don't tend to be a doomsdayer by nature. What I think that I don't know that I most worry about it, but what I get sort of most, and I guess I can only speak to my area. You know, I've spent much of the past two decades on science and technology issues and on the national security of science and technology. And I think there's a tendency to people to be doomsdayers about technology. You know, I get so irritated, I must say, by the sort of breathless articles on artificial intelligence being threats to humanity. And I guess I look at it, I'm like, no, humanity is, you know, the biggest threat to humanity. if you look at the history of warfare, of killing, you know, of the things I write about, of drones, you don't need artificial intelligence to kill people. If you think that is the threat to humanity, then you need to get out into the world, because there are a lot of people dying in Yemen in a senseless war that has nothing to do with artificial intelligence. And that's what people should be focused on, not these theoretical technological threats. I write about how technologies are used to kill people. The people using that are people. I think worrying about things that don't exist and probably won't exist for decades, if not ever, is ignoring the real threats that we face today. So that
absolutely. Yeah. And those threats are current and they are going to continue. Like, that's the thing. Like, you're writing about things that are now, but you're also writing about things that are going to continue within the future.
I guess I put it this way. I wish that the people writing these letters on outlawing artificial intelligence or whatever it is would actually spend that time worrying about the war in Yemen, the war anywhere, things that actually are killing people. It would be a better use of effort. The thing that gives me hope. Yeah, so that's a good question. I guess the flip side of that is, you know, humanity has a fundamental ability to survive. We adapt. You know, I think when people get a little too wrapped up in the current political situation, I say, actually, I think we're doing pretty well. We adapt.
Yeah, you know, I like to think that maybe the current political situation feels incredibly jarring simply because we have made some progress historically, and that sometimes when things take a left turn, it can make you realize how far you've come and how far you could potentially fall. And I don't know if you have a similar stance on that, and it's totally fine if you don't, but that's what kind of helps me sleep at night a little bit, is that things feel bleak now, but they only feel bleak in comparison to where we've come from. And that's maybe a silver lining.
Yeah, I'm an optimist at heart.
I like that. I really do. So, Sharon, I have to thank you for joining me. Will you let everybody who's listening know, other than the book, where they can find your regular work?
Sure. So I edit at Foreign Policy Magazine. So that's foreignpolicy.com. My other work can be found either at my website, which is SharonWeinberger.com. They can also check out the article I wrote about how DARPA created the modern field of climate science at MIT's UnDark magazine.
Okay, cool. And guys, the book is The Imagineers of War, The Untold Story of DARPA, the Pentagon Agency that Changed the World. And it is available in paperback wherever books are sold. So I highly recommend you pick up a copy. Sharon, thank you once again for joining me. And everybody, thank you for coming back week after week. I'm really looking forward to the next time we all get together to talk nerdy.